Welcome to the Working Mom's Guide to Sanity podcast, your go-to resource for support, advice, and inspiration as you navigate the challenges of balancing your ambitious career dreams and your family. Each week, I'll bring you interviews with powerhouse working moms who'll share their insights on how they manage to find sanity while juggling their demanding jobs and kids. I'm your coach, Elizabeth Pearson. I'm an executive coach for women in male-dominated fields, and boy, have I heard it all. I've experienced a lot. I'm a mother of two young girls, and the women that I interview somehow built these businesses, climbed the ranks of corporate America, and followed their dreams, all while being a mother and clinging to their sanity. And you can do it too. Each week, I'll show you how. Welcome to the show. I'm your coach, Elizabeth Pearson, and today's guest is Dr. Taryn Marie. She is the number one Wall Street Journal best-selling author of The 5 Practices of Highly Resilient People: Why Some Flourish and Why Some Fold. Gosh, don't we always wonder that? Like, how do some people overcome so much in their lives? And she's a wonderful example of overcoming the odds and really true resilience. And I always had, you know, kind of a love-hate relationship with this word of, should we be resilient or should we actually be getting support? Should we actually be getting understanding? And so we talked about that, and we had a wonderful conversation on what the difference is between, you know, head down, white knuckling it through life and true resilience, and what's the upside of both of those, if there is one. So I got a lot out of the conversation with Dr. Taryn, and I really hope you do too. I think that you'll get some really great nuggets from this show. So thanks for listening. Dr. Taryn, thank you so much for being here. You guys, this is a huge get. I've been a fan for a long time, and I actually, you know, listened to this wonderful episode that Dr. Taryn did on Ed Milet's show. Everybody knows I love him as well. And I was hanging on every word that she said. It was such an easy listen. His show's a little bit longer. It's a little bit like an hour, maybe a little bit over. And it went by like that. And so I said, I have to try to get her on the show to talk not only about resilience, but how it applies to working moms, because I do feel like it's this kind of asterisk behind our name. You know, here's what I am. Here's what I do. Here's where I live. And then, oh, by the way, I do all of this while being a mother. So thank you so much for being on the show, Dr. Taryn.
Oh, thank you. It's a delight to be here. I'm so happy to be here with you. Ed Milet is amazing. Just so a wonderful, wonderful person inside and out. It was incredible to be on his show. And I'm delighted to be your, get. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, totally. Well, so one thing that you said on his show, and you've posted a little bit on your Instagram, you guys in the show notes, be sure to go and follow her, is that it's okay to not be okay. And I just was hoping you could expand a little bit on that for some of the moms and maybe dads too who are listening. I think it's a great little kind of like Instagram quote post, but I would love for you to dig a little bit deeper of what you mean when you say that.
Yeah. So when I say it's okay to not be okay, what I mean is that my experience as a working mother for a period of time, as a single mother, as a parent, it's like a tale of two cities. And at any given moment, it feels like it's the best of times, you know, our kids just made this like beautiful card for us or some kind of artwork, and it's the worst of times. Our child hauled off and punched somebody in the face, didn't turn in their homework, talked back to us, you know, something of that nature. And I think one of the really difficult things for me about being a parent, being a working mom, is just that constant feeling of like, even when everything's great, it feels like it can and likely will, at least in my case, like come crashing down at any moment. And so even when everything's great, I have a sense of anxiety or a sense of dread that like the other shoe's going to drop, or when is it going to drop? Even like when our kids were little, you know, it's like they could be totally fine, like just in a good mood. But you know, in a minute, if you get 5 minutes over that nap time line, that like, you know, everything's going to break loose. And so I think sometimes there's just this impending sense of dread, even when everything is wonderful. And to constantly be going from a really high-powered career where a lot is asked of us and a really extensive home life where a lot is asked of us, even if we have this sort of beautiful existence that we've created, it can really feel exhausting and like I never get a break and maybe you never get a break. And it's just, we kind of go from one swirl to the next. And so to think that we also need to do that with a smile, to be, you know, completely happy with how everything we're going, I think is just, it's too much to ask. And so it's okay to not be okay, even if you don't know why you're not okay. You're just not okay at the moment. And that's okay.
So is this a time when we should, quote unquote, dig deep and be resilient and maybe carry that emotional labor of modeling for our kids that it's okay and everything's actually okay? Or do you think that it's okay for kids to see you not okay? That's one thing that even, you know, I am lucky enough to have a partner, and sometimes I'll get upset in front of the kids and maybe I'll lose it. Maybe I'll, you know, say shit or something. And my husband will kind of look at me like, okay, well, let's not let them like see you upset. And so I always find this kind of tightrope of like, how much do we let them see our emotions to the point where we don't want to scare them? We don't want them to feel unsafe. And I, for one thing, I definitely don't want them to feel like they're responsible for my emotions. And I always tell them, mommy's upset. You don't need to fix it. You can't fix it. Being here and letting them out is all I need. But I always wonder about that. Like when we say it's okay to not be okay, is it okay to not be okay in front of your kids?
Great question. Okay. First of all, like, I want to grow up as like a child in your household. I mean, this sounds like fantastic. Like, I think I'd be like president of the United States with the way that you're parenting your children. Like, you're upset in the moment, and in the midst of being upset, you're like having a side conversation with your children about how they can think about you being upset. I mean, that's amazing.
But I think it's because I grew up not with that, as that was not modeled. When my parents were upset, it was, I felt like I needed to fix it. And sometimes they would even say, come give me a hug and make me feel better, or something like that. And I think as a child, that's how I become a people pleaser, you know? And I was always, my parents were divorced, so I was always trying to kind of like make both sides happy. So it is one thing that I feel like I'm just hyper aware of with my children, because I want them to know that my emotions are mine. They didn't make me feel any way. Only I can make myself feel that way. And therefore they are not responsible and have no ability to change my emotions.
Yeah. I mean, I love this. And I grew up with, you know, not exactly that, but some versions of what you're saying. And, you know, one of the things that I think really helps guide me as a parent and really helps guide a lot of people is, to your point, even if we didn't get the parenting, you know, that we would have wanted, like there's a lot of us that grow up with like great parents, but they just weren't good in some areas, or maybe we wanted something differently, or maybe, you know, you didn't have great parenting and you're like, well, how am I going to do this if I didn't have a sound role model? And I think the way that we do this is we get to think about how we can be the big person that we would have wanted to have when we were a little person. And I can't tell you how many times that has guided me into, okay, I'm not really sure what to do here. I didn't necessarily what I would have wanted in this situation. But I do know what I had hoped for, or what I would have liked to have had. And this isn't answering your question directly, so I'll get to that. But, you know, I think what's really powerful is in those moments, and I don't know if this has felt true for you, in the moments where then I've shown up and gotten to be the big person that I would have wanted to have as a little person, not only did that create a beautiful experience for my children, but some kind of special parenting alchemy occurred where in parenting my children the way I wanted to be parented, somehow it felt like I was also, the child in me was also receiving that parenting at the same time, even though I wasn't receiving it. And so there's something really incredible, I think, about being able to offer things to our children that we didn't have, that not only gives them a new opportunity that wasn't available to us, but also sort of alchemizes the parenting we receive and makes it feel like we actually did get it.
I love that. It totally does. I mean, and our kids likely look like us. I mean, unless, you know, they came to you in another form or fashion, like my little one, my youngest, looks very similar to me, especially when I was that age. And so quite often I will look at her as if she's my inner child. And I will say, you know, everything's okay and you don't have to do that. And to your point, it's like a double win because she's feeling acknowledged, but at the same time, I can almost mentally go into this place of, this is what I wish somebody would have said to me. And this is how I wish that my mother would have reacted. And, you know, listen, the boomers get a pass, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's doing the best that they could. But I do feel like it has been healing to let go of some of that resentment and blame that I have had for them, to actively be able to do it with ours. So I think these little souls are guided to us for a reason. And maybe that's part of the reason, right? Is to heal some of these wounds from our childhood, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was told about this spiritual belief one time when I was doing some self-development. And by the way, I'm always doing self-development. It's,
so good.
It's never done. And I remember one of the practitioners that I was working with taught me about this spiritual belief that I had chosen my parents. And there were a lot of things in my childhood that didn't go the way that I thought that I would have wanted them to. And in that moment, I was like, what?
Right. No, like, thanks. I didn't choose them. Yeah.
I didn't choose that. I didn't choose for that to happen. And then when I had the opportunity to really step back and reflect on that over some time, what I realized was, and this is related to, you know, some of my work on resilience, is that those things that happened, even though I wouldn't have chosen it, or at least wouldn't have consciously chosen it, the fact that it did happen, right? The fact, I'll give some examples, some high level, the fact that I had a stalker from the age of 14 to 18 and developed post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that for the next 20 years until I was 34. The fact that I was dyslexic and had a profound learning disability and nobody realized it, and I went through all of my formal education feeling some kind of way about the self-esteem that I had, about what kind of learner I was. I taught myself to read, you know, and then I was diagnosed with dyslexia at age 37, you know, helpfully after I had completed all of my formal schooling. And so there's things that I was like, you know, like, why would I ever choose that? And yet in telling these stories, what I realize is, although it doesn't seem like I would consciously choose those experiences, those are the experiences that actually formed me most fundamentally, most significantly into the person I am today. And in that moment, I could think to myself, and maybe I wouldn't have wanted this to happen, but darn it, if it hasn't, you know, sort of elevated my learning and my compassion and perhaps, you know, the journey that my soul has meant to be on.
Right. And maybe our soul, when it's up there, doesn't see good or bad experiences, right? It's just an experience to it. And so maybe the experience of a stalker is like, oh, okay, well, we'll see what that's like. And then we get down here and we're like, no, like that is not a good experience. But I think our souls just innocently are kind of like, ooh, let's experience this and let's see if we can get through this dyslexia. And frankly, your stalker story is haunting. It was one of those things, like it was so deep, you know, even when you shared it with Ed, I felt like haunted for a little while after that. I started like closing my daughter's windows more, like I might have you tell it just a little bit, but I grew up too with a neighbor and I was a latchkey kid. So my mom was, and my parents were divorced. So a lot of times I was left to my own devices, you know, early grade school, coming home and then locking the door, right? So you would just kind of like lock yourself in the house. And we had this neighbor who, I don't know, he was always drunk. It was some guy, the guy owned the house and this was his cousin or something that was staying there. And he used to come over after school and he would beat on our door and he would yell my mom's name and he was like wasted. And then he went through this time where he was actually stealing my dog, like out of our yard, and would just keep her. And I used to look into his, you know, basement windows and see my dog down there. And he would be down there with my dog and I couldn't get her. And it was this just awful thing. But so a lot of days when I would come home from school, if he was drunk, his name was Paul, he would come and beat on the windows and the doors. And I would hide in a bathroom cabinet because I thought, well, he can't see me in there. And then my mom would come home and, you know, she was doing her best, but she would say, oh, he's fine. He's not going to get it. It's fine. You know, just like a total dismissal. And I look back on that now, like I'm sure you do with the stalker and stuff. I mean, in the moment, you knew it was messed up, right? And in the moment, I knew it was messed up and he wasn't touching me, but it just created this total fear of being alone, you know, and being totally unsafe. But I can look back on that now and know really deep down inside that no matter what situation you're going to put me in, I got 9 lives. Like, I will be fine. I will get out of it. So maybe that's the blessing from these childhood traumas, no?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think our sort of capacity, let me say it this way. I've never quite said it this way, but I like this metaphor that's coming up for me. So, you know, if you get a goldfish, right, and it lives for a period of time, it'll grow to fit its container, you know? And then if you put it in a bigger container, right, it'll grow even bigger. And I think our capacity to deal with hard things is like that goldfish. We grow into the size of the container of the experience that we've had. And the larger the container of that trauma that we've had, of the disappointment, of the rejection, of the loss, I think when we do our own work on healing, then we have this incredibly large capacity to be able to live our lives, to support our children, to be in service to the people around us. And, you know, then the little things, you know, that are trivial don't seem to carry so much weight, because we're saying to ourselves, look, if someone turns in this report late, if the kids don't have the right shoes for their first soccer practice, if the folders aren't the exact color that the teacher needs them to be, that's okay, because we've dealt with things of much greater magnitude. And I think we're able to then file that in its appropriate place because we have this extended or expanded capacity.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love too in the book how you talk about vulnerability. And I think this is great because there are a lot of female leaders who listen to the show. And I think as women, we can try to shapeshift a little bit into being like men in the C-suite or in executive roles, and this whole, you know, never let them see you sweat. But I love how you really start to examine that. So could you share a little bit with the audience about what you mean by that, how vulnerability can actually be a strength and can be a wonderful point of connection?
Absolutely. And I think maybe what I'll do, like, as a bridge to this conversation about vulnerability is, I didn't answer your question about like how much we should let our children see us upset.
Okay, please.
Yeah. And there's vulnerability in that, right? There's vulnerability in allowing our children to see that we're upset. And so I'll sort of answer that question as a bridge into the professional world, if that's okay.
Love it.
And so, you know, the way that I think about what I share with my children is, I think, okay, I am the pilot of this plane. My children do not know how to fly a plane. I know how to fly a plane, but they don't, right? And so they are passengers in this plane. And so when we're on a flight, you know, we get communication from the pilot all the time, right? There's a thunderstorm outside. Someone took our gate. We got to go back to the gate. You know, now, you know, they got to refuel, like whatever it is, right? And a pilot might let us know, you know, hey, they're feeling frustrated. They're feeling disappointed. They're not happy with the decision that was made or how it came down. But what the pilot's not saying to us, the pilot's not saying, I don't know how to fly this plane. You are in danger. Someone's going to need to come up here and take these controls, right? And so I think that's a really good metaphor for us as parents, is that we can be authentic with our children. We can be vulnerable with our children about our emotional process. And in fact, our children are going to learn from us how to give voice to their emotional process, how to share their emotional process by role modeling based on what they see us do. And yet in that process, I think we also get to do just what you said, which is to make sure that they know, you know, we're not asking them to fly the plane, right? I'm not asking you to take the controls and to be responsible for my feelings, right? Mm-hmm. I still have this. I'm still at the helm. Everything's okay. We're not going to crash. You're not in danger. I'm just frustrated, you know, that there's a gate change or we're taking off later than we thought, or, you know, something of that nature. So I think we get to think about, as a pilot of our children's lives, really sharing with them like some of the more deeper, authentic, or even vulnerable layers, and in a way that they still feel safe on their journey.
I love that. I mean, and I love that too. Like, they don't have to know what all the buttons are up front. And if they did, they would probably get freaked out. So like even to that point. But I think they can know that mommy's frustrated with daddy. I think they can know mommy doesn't feel like going for a walk, but she's going to do it anyway, you know, or mommy doesn't want to make a second dinner because you don't like this one. Like, I think that there is this, right, we have to just put it through our own filter of like, what's a need to know and what's a, they don't really need to know to that level. But I do like the normalization of emotions because I think a lot of times women, I've got some friends who've recently gone through divorces and they are just really trying to keep it high vibe for their kids all the time. They're taking them on vacations. They're taking, you know what I mean? It's a lot of like trying to, I think, make up for the sad times that they've gone through. And I totally understand it. But I've often wondered myself, like, it's probably okay for your kids to see you sad. Like, you're going through a divorce and it's awful. Like, you don't have to put on them why you're getting a divorce or any of these things. But I think it's probably okay for them to see you having a sad day and just saying, you know, I'm a little sad today. I don't, how do you think, how do you feel about that? Because there is a lot of divorce out there, right? There always has been. But like, what level should children be aware of what's going on in your relationship as it pertains to like a partnership within the home?
I think the most important indicator there is how old your children are, because what is going to be developmentally appropriate at 15 isn't going to be developmentally appropriate at 5. What I'd say a couple of things. One is, you know, I think it's really important to not sort of whitewash the sadness, do you know, like just try to paint over it as though it's not there, because our children have and will experience sadness. And in the, you know, the example of divorce, you know, especially if the divorce is from a parent, is from a person that is that child's like biological parent, you know, or a parent, a step parent that they have a long-standing relationship with, they're going to feel sad about that too, and confused, right? And just going on vacation and doing fun things on the weekends and pretending like everything's great. It teaches our children not to experience their sadness and instead to distract themselves with other things, right? So being able to show up and to say, to talk about the emotion, right? To talk about like, I'm feeling sad today. And I think that's the first thing. The second thing is to ensure that kids know that it's not their fault. Kids are really good at thinking that like they probably did something wrong and that's making you sad, right? So I'm feeling sad today. It is absolutely not your fault. You know, we can also talk to our children about our somatization. When I feel sad, here's where I feel it in my body. My throat feels kind of constricted. It feels kind of hard to talk. You know, maybe I feel hot, you know, I get a headache, right? So they can start to like begin to identify their own emotions. And then maybe that's a good time, like rather than talking about your own process as a parent, to like turn it over to them and say, you know, do you ever feel sad? When was the last time, you know, that you can recognize that you had sad feelings? What was that related to? And, you know, I think a lot of times as parents, we get so enmeshed with our children that we don't want them to have any bad feelings, you know? So our children come to us and they say, you know, I'm sad that this happened. And we're like, how can you feel sad? I just took you for ice cream. Like, how could you possibly be sad? Right. And they're like, oh, okay. I guess I shouldn't say that I feel that way, or I shouldn't access that emotion. Right. So when our children come to us and talk about their own feelings, you know, or when we solicit them, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to also just ask more questions about that rather than telling them how they should feel or how we'd like them to feel or how they can't possibly feel that way, you know, to say, oh, you feel sad. Tell me more about that. What's creating these sad feelings for you, or what happened, right? To be curious about our child's internal space. Yeah. So yeah, I have a story I can tell you too about.
Yes, please.
I was married to my son's father. I have two sons. They're 11 and 9. And I was married to their father, I think for 8 or 9 years. And we got divorced. And then I was single for about 5 years. And then during the pandemic, I met someone who seemed really Prince Charming-like, just amazing and wonderful and all the things. And so I moved in with him and I started to notice some things that didn't really add up. And, you know, it was still kind of in the midst of the pandemic and we were like cut off from everyone. So now we're into 2021 and we ended up getting married. And by 2022, I was like, this isn't working. Like, this is not good. And based on the way that he would talk to me or the way that he would yell or like the names that he would call me, I was like, I know. Yep. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, this is not okay. There's a significant divergence here, even just between like the person that I am and what I want in a relationship and, you know, and how I'm being treated in a really fundamental way. And so first, my psychological safety was eroded. I just didn't feel like I could talk about certain things. I walked on eggshells. I knew the things that would upset him. And I tried to like just keep everything copacetic. Yeah. And then there was a series of events that happened toward the end of last year where my physical safety was eroded, where he physically came at me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Not awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he had a nice relationship with my sons who are, you know, 11 and 9. And so there was an opportunity, you know, there's several opportunities, right, to talk with them about, and fortunately they didn't witness any of the physical stuff. We were driving home one night and I said to them, look, I've got a plan for us. It's kind of two stages. One is for us to move out of the house that we're in, where we were living with him, and into like a beautiful apartment of our own with like a swimming pool. They like to stay at hotels. Who doesn't? Yeah. You know, it has a lobby that looks like a hotel. And then I said, you know, and then the second part is, you know, for me to save up for a down payment on that home that we've, you know, been dreaming about. And that'll take, you know, a year and a half. And they said, okay, Mom, that sounds great. And I said, and how would you feel if it was just the three of us making that move? So just, you know, me and my two sons, not the person that I was married to. And then he had three children from a prior marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And they said, and so my oldest son, you know, who was turning 11, he knew, right, what this conversation was. And he thought about it thoughtfully and he said, Mom, I'm okay with that. And my younger son said, I will feel better because there won't be yelling and I won't feel kind of anxious. And so we implemented that plan. And then in the context of that car ride, my younger son fell asleep. So this kind of goes back to what you were saying about like, what do you tell children? And so I said to my older son, who was in the process of turning 11, I was able to give him more age-appropriate information than I could give, you know, my 9-year-old at the time. And I said, when we moved in with this person, I thought that he was much farther down the path in terms of having done his own work and development and healing. And now I see that he isn't. And not only that, there's a lot of concerns that he has with his children. And I said, I don't think it's fair for us to sort of have a front row seat to all this like volatility that has nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. And they actually don't need an audience for what right. they're in the process of working through. That's not fair to them either. So that was the high level description that I gave my older son. And he turns to me and he says, Mom, and he said the person's name. He said, if that person could just regulate his emotions, everything would be okay.
My God. See, look at that. I mean, and not for nothing, but for boys too, to be that emotionally mature at 11 is a huge win. I mean, even though it's a gut-wrenching conversation, Dr. Taryn, I hope you were able to take a little bit of credit and solace, give yourself a little bit of something, some acknowledgement for that response, right? Because there's no way he would have had that response without you modeling that for him. That's huge. Well, so if we bring this into the boardroom, this is another thing. Some of my friends who've been recently divorced, a couple of them were because their partners had addiction problems and they felt a lot of shame about anybody even discovering that they were going through a divorce. But they've also been really reluctant to give any reason why, even though it could be somewhat validating for them. This whole, it's not just because you know, I failed at this. It's like when somebody has addiction issues, I mean, that I feel like that's really the control being completely taken out of your hands, right? There's only so much work you can do when somebody else isn't addressing their addiction problems. But so how vulnerable can we be at work? Like if we're using this divorce example, is that something that you should be sharing? Is that a potential point of deep connection with others? Or do we need to give them the pilot kind of analogy here of like, I'm getting a divorce, but then stop the buck there from sharing anything, specifically as women, because we don't want to get, you know, kind of like that stereotypical, she's emotional, or maybe you're going through a lot right now, so we won't give you this project.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
But I'm like, at this point, like the vulnerability superpower, right? Again, I think the listeners could just really benefit from like, do we treat them like the 15-year-old or do they get treated like the 7-year-old, the coworkers?
It's a great question. So I think the first thing for us to acknowledge is that all places of work and all colleagues and all organizational cultures are not created equally, right? So we're not talking about, you know, just there's just so much variability, right? In terms of where people are working, what their relationships are with their colleagues and peers, and the extent to which sharing more deeply is accepted or not accepted, you know, in your place, in your place of work. You know, vulnerability is the first practice of highly resilient people in my book. So the people who most effectively faced challenge and demonstrated the greatest amount of resilience were also the ones who were the most vulnerable. And vulnerable doesn't mean sharing everything. Doesn't mean being completely transparent. Vulnerability means to the greatest extent possible to allow what we're feeling and thinking and our experience on the inside to match what we're sharing with the world on the outside. And for those two things to like be as congruent as possible. And the first question that we get to ask ourselves when we're thinking about the people in our lives that we want to go deeper with is, has this person or has these people or has this organizational culture earned the right to hear about my vulnerability, to hear about some of the deepest, most difficult things that I'm going through, I'm in the midst of, or I'm coming out on the other side of? And it can be really vulnerable to tell stories from our past, right? It's vulnerable for me every time I talk about the stalker situation and the PTSD. And yet I've done my work on that. And so if I share that in the context of a podcast or up on stage as a keynote speaker, I'm not looking to my audience to support me, to validate me, to help carry me through this moment, right? Yes. And so when we're in the midst of something like a divorce, especially with someone who, you know, has grappled with some kind of addiction, right? We are looking for support. And so we get to look first and foremost for the markers of, you know, how have these people or this entity earned the right to hear about this vulnerability from me? Have I seen people in my organization handle this well? Have I confided in a colleague before and been delighted to know that they were a source of support and that they could, you know, also like keep my information in confidence and not share it with other people, right? And so I think those are some questions that we get to ask ourselves because it is such a tenuous and difficult time. And I think as women, a lot of times our tendency is to want to explain things, is to want to explain ourselves, is to want to explain why. And like, here's what it is. We don't owe anyone an explanation.
Oh, I love that.
Period.
And that on a t-shirt. I know. We don't
owe anyone an explanation. Like we don't. Because, you know, we got to make everybody feel good about it. We got to make everybody feel good about the fact that we're getting married or having a child or getting divorced. You know, it's like everybody's got to like, and they don't. Like, we don't owe anyone an explanation at all, period, end of story. So from a place of, I don't owe anyone an explanation for choices that I've made in my life as an adult, from there we get to decide how much we want to share in that moment.
Oh my gosh, Dr. Taryn, mic drop. I mean, that's it. Like, I think that we all know if we're talking to somebody or sharing because we want a little support and we feel like it's a trusted person who can provide us some support? Or is it the other, right? Is it option B, which is, I feel like I need to explain myself, or I feel like I need to somehow control the narrative. So I'm going to disclose things so that they don't come up with some other alternative story in their mind. But at the end of the day, like, it's none of our fucking business, right? Like, what they think of us, who cares? Like, at this point in our lives, I would hope that we would be a little bit more comfortable with not believing that we can control what somebody's thinking about us. Because you can sit there and explain away, oh, it's because he's an alcoholic, or, and they'll just sit there and nod. And like, you still have no idea what kind of judgment they might be passing or any of this. So to your point, like, I think that's really good. Like the qualifier of like, am I looking for support? Can they be trusted? Or is this because I feel like I need to explain something that might not be any other business?
Yeah. And maybe the third one is, you know, again, and I think this is like, we get to, you know, look, go deep, as you talked about earlier, and look within ourselves. Another thing that we do is we think, am I making the right decision? Right? We're like doubting ourselves. We don't, we don't know if it's the right thing. And so also possibly through disclosure of what's going on, we're asking other people their opinion, like, is this okay? Am I making the right decision? Do you think I should? And it's like, no, no, no. People cannot give us directions to places they've never been.
So true. Yet why do we ask them? We ask them all the time.
Because we think they know, or we think they know better than we do, because we doubt ourselves, because we don't trust ourselves, because someone taught us that we shouldn't pay attention to our feelings. And so, you know, we get to trust ourselves that we're making the right decision, that we are the captain of our ship, that no one has walked a mile in our shoes, that we know better than anybody else. And to disclose, to kind of say like, is it okay? Am I doing this right? Do you think I ought to, you know, our peers at work are not in a position to give us directions to places they've never been.
Right. We can't take advice from the cheap seats in the back, right? And so many times we open ourselves up for it. I tell clients too, a lot of times when they're thinking about starting a business, I say, we've got this little seedling and we're planting it in the garden and we have to put a fence up because some of these friends and family, coworkers specifically, can just be wearing boots and they can just walk around in our garden stomping around. They have no idea that there's these little seedlings trying to come up. So for a while, we need to put a fence until those seedlings get big enough that they can see them and avoid them. Or if the seedling gets bumped by the boot, it doesn't take it out. But like, I think it's okay to put up those walls when you're in a very vulnerable place like that, and something that they could say off the cuff or without a lot of insight or not from a place of experience could really be crushing and could take you back a couple notches, right? So, God, I love that. You guys, you have to get her book and make sure to follow. You've got such great content. She gives away so much for free in terms of like content. It's a great kind of like launching point. But the 5 behaviors that promote resilience in team too, I feel like this is such a great, I've got the graphic pulled up from your IG, vulnerability, productive, perseverance, connection, gratiosity. Oh, I love that one. And assuming positive intent. That's so huge. I can't tell you how many times I have to tell clients that too. You just got to assume everybody's doing their best. Nobody's out here trying to be malicious. And that can be in personal relationships too, right, Dr. Taryn?
Absolutely. I can't tell you how many times assuming positive intent has kept me from looking like a complete jerk in so many situations where I'm like, hi, I see you're not in the office today. They're like, yeah, don't you remember? You approved my vacation 2 weeks ago. And I'm like, oh, right. You know, or like, I think that project is due today and you were going to turn, you know, that thing into me. And they're like, oh, remember we revised the project plan and I'm not getting you the documents on Wednesday. And I'm like, I would have sounded like such a jerk.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. Her book, The 5 Practices of Highly Resilient People, is a bestseller all over the place. Number one in personal growth. It's huge. I love anytime I can see a female author, you know, on that wonderful NASDAQ sign in New York City. So congrats on giving advice from a place of experience. That's what I love too. Like, I love the self-help arena. And there are a few that really stand out, like, you know, Ed and Lewis and those. but I love women speaking from a place of experience to women who are the biggest purchasers and consumers of self-help. And so thank you for your contribution, everybody. I can't recommend it enough. Thank you for your very precious time spent with us today and our listeners, Dr. Taryn. There is definitely a lot to be able to take away and utilize from this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a joy and an honor to be here with you. And I am just delighted to hear from your listeners about how they loved our conversation.
Yeah, no, they definitely will. You guys be sure to hit her up on her Instagram and let her know. Okay,